Hello from Wokingham, England. I'm Tim Lathwaite, and you're listening to Remember the Way with Xavier.
Welcome to episode 3 in this part of our journey with church, school, and the kitchen sink. My conversation with Alice Fabian Williams, school chaplain of Inanda Seminary, takes us to some interesting places: God's calling, vocation, how to work out God's will for your life, the realities of school post-COVID, looking towards the future and dealing with things like AI, advancing God's kingdom in the school context. However, our conversation begins with me asking Alice to share about the amazing legacy of the school situated right in the middle of Inanda Township. Here we go.
Cool. Well, I'm Alice, and amongst a number of things, I'm an ordained minister within the Congregational Church. And one of our church schools is the, as the UCCS says, Inanda Seminary, where I live and serve and have done for the past 6 years. And it's a really incredible space. It's a real privilege to be able to be here. It's one of the hopeful stories which we kind of need in the context of our time, where often we don't find so many of those stories. But it's a high school for girls, it's a full boarding school, and it's right in the heart of Inanda Township, which is it's quite a difficult space, but yet we have this real oasis. It's a beautiful campus. It's got jacaranda trees and an avenue of gum trees that you come down to get to it. And it's really just incredible. But it was originally started by missionaries in 1869. And to be honest, it was really the missionary wives. It's kind of they get the credit, but it was the wives who did it. So Adams College had been started by the men missionaries and the mums and toti. And they had started the school in order to educate boys, many of whom were the first Christian converts who they kind of see to go on to be the ministers of word and sacrament. And then their wives recognized that there were these men at Adams College who would need partners who were kind of equal and good matches to them in their education and vision. So they were able to start Inanda Seminary. Mm. So 154 years ago, which is, as you said, a long time. I mean, as far as I can see in my research, it's about 110 around there, give or take a few older school that's still functioning in the country. And what's more remarkable is that on that list, it's a real outlier. The majority of the schools that are kind of top 100 were established in the Cape, predominantly for white boys. And so we have this kind of really incredible space, which has been a vision for isiZulu girls to be educated from, you know, long ago. And, you know, it started, there were a few kind of notable matches that happened between Adams and Inanda. For example, John Dube. He was the founding president of the Natal Native Congress. He was the forerunner, which obviously was a forerunner of the ANC. And he married a member, Nokutela Dube, and they were quite a remarkable couple together. There was Nokukanya Lutuli, wife of Chief Albert Lutuli, Edith Yengwa, wife to Masabalala Yengwa. And I mean, there's so many others who were mentioned. But having said that, the school kind of went on to be bigger than just the vision of producing good wives. It's delivered like top quality education throughout all the apartheid years. We've come to see so many of South Africa's most prominent female leadership having come from the school. So whether it's politics or business, they were products of the seminary. And I'm just going to give you like a brief list, because I think only when you hear it, you realize the magnitude of it.
Yeah, that would be great.
The first qualified African nurse, Natal's first state certified African female educator, the first black female social worker, the first black woman to qualify as a medical doctor, the first black woman to be buried with full military honors. We've had government ministers, many of them, MECs.
I mean, I literally get chills, like literally when you talk, when you go through that list like that, I'm just like, wow.
It's like blue chip companies, deputy president, speaker of national parliament. And it just goes on and on and on. I mean, I could really bore you, but when you kind of get a sense of, of there are a lot of incredible people who were at the forefront of changing the face of the country, of being good examples of just capable women, right? Of changing that narrative. They were members from an under seminary. And just maybe some context, just hearing myself say that, you'll hear me refer to members a lot. And the idea comes from we don't call our girls students or girls or that kind of thing. They're members, because the understanding is that once you enroll here, you're part of the family. You're a member of this family. And so also the girls, formally, when they introduce me, they might call me Rev Alice or something like that. But they mostly refer to me as Ma Rev or Ma Alice. And all the other staff will also be Ma, because it's this idea that we are, the hope is that we will be a family unit. So, that's kind of a context of where we've come from, but it's a very different context and space now. I mean, there's a lot of history in that, and we've seen the school's mission shifting. Originally, it did kind of, if you look at who was here, it was the parents who would believe in education for girls, which was quite unusual for the time. It was quite a sacrifice, you know, you're losing a pair of hands at home. And it would have to be for those who could afford it mostly. I mean, there was lots of external funding. But it was, that was kind of who came, who the members were. And people would come from far away because it was a boarding school. So it was one of the few good options. And so people would do a lot, you know, stories of girls walking 50 kilometers to get here, you know, for the start of term and things like that. But obviously we're no longer in that position as a country, thankfully, where this is the only option for Black girls. But we still see ourselves as filling a gap. Private schooling in South Africa is exceptional. It's really, when you look at this, like, you know, from an educational side, it's really world class. But the problem is that only 10% of our children have access to it. The other 90% is, I don't know how else to describe it. Often we say it's really dismal. It's disheartening. It's not really what we should, a level that we should be accepting as a country. And so we're kind of in this middle space where we are a private school. We do the NSC exams, so the national exams, but we're a low fee school. And so what we do with as little as we can, really, I think we try to do it well and to be exceptional still, to be at the level of those other schools. And there are those who can afford private or X Model C schools, but they might still choose to come to us, possibly because of our history. But not only I think that, I think, you know, we still strive for excellence. And while we've done that with education, we've still maintained a real African ethos. It's, you know, through music, through the sports we play, the food, as well as a real celebration of culture. You know, that's something that is important to a lot of people. And so they might choose us for that. Or they might also, we're quite, the school, before my time, I kind of slotted in and hoped to have grown it, but it was really the tradition I bought into or came into, where social emotional learning has been really a priority for the school. And so things like what we call circles are timetabled into our weekly rotation, where girls are, where our members are invited to learn how to have difficult conversations, where it's just a time set aside to deal with, you know, whether it's things in the classroom or in the world that are happening, to be able to develop, you know, a real holistic self. It's been really amazing to see a lot of kind of the more prominent schools, possibly more well-known, kind of looking to the school as an example to be able to do that within their own context. And so that's, yeah, it's been an amazing place to be a part of. It's been a real privilege. And I suppose I'm really excited to share on a podcast, because it's like this hidden gem that so many people in Durban don't even know about. And yet we've been here for so long and done well for so long.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to kind of allow others the space to see what it is that happens.
Yeah, well, I think for me, like, having had some experience of like ministry and ministry in schools for a number of years in South Africa, I know when we reconnected, I was like surprised, probably, and I shouldn't have been surprised, because I mean, God is always at work, right, in ways that we can't imagine. But I was so surprised that there was this school, this legacy, this ministry that was taking place, you know. And I was just, like I've said before, totally blown away about it. Your description of it being an oasis is interesting for me, because I know that obviously over the 154 years, like you said, things have changed a lot. And so am I right? Does it border right on Inanda Township? Is that right? Hey?
It doesn't border on it, is it? In the heart of it.
It's in the heart of it, hey? Yeah, in the heart of it.
It's where you can drive 20 minutes whichever way and you're still going to be
in the heart of it, right? Yeah, yeah. So could you, just for context a little bit there, and I know we're going to probably chat a bit later about challenges and stuff, but just briefly, like, offer a little bit of a description. So we know about the school and its history, but just around that, you know, what is taking place in that township? Just a little bit. I mean, for many people living in South Africa, we understand the reality of maybe a township. But I think for a lot of people from overseas who might listen in on this, they would hear the word and maybe not know what we mean by that, right? A few descriptors just to explain context there, as best you can for them.
I suppose it's quite a difficult one because what I, knowing I was coming to serve and live here, a township is quite different in your mind's eye as it is in reality. Okay. But it is a difficult space. So Nando's itself was maybe 25 years ago more rural, and just the ways, even in my 6 years, I mean, I really haven't been here long, to see how kind of increasingly densely populated it has become, which obviously makes it more difficult for, you know, even just families to do a little bit of subsistence farming.
Yeah.
And so you see, you know, kind of as you drive along, even every verge has kind of little rows of spinach and things like that growing.
Mm.
Just kind of people trying to have a stopgap, you know, between what they just food as a basic necessity.
Yeah. So low income area. Yeah.
Yeah, very low income. Yeah. And in fact, I hate to kind of say this, but it's like one of the kind of crime hotspots in the country.
Yeah.
In under the, you know, is known as very much one of the places with terrible statistics.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, comes to GBV or, you know, murder and things like that. It's really a difficult space. And in fact, even more recently, you know, COVID, but the 2021 looting, it really decimated it. I know there was a lot of kind of media attention on the wealthier areas, on, you know, the big shops and stuff, which were destroyed. But I think it was only in about August or July this year. So, you know, a good years later, where we've had our first shop come back, which has been really difficult because, you know, there are a few little tuck shops where people have had to get Ubers, which they can't afford, to go do their monthly groceries at Gateway, which is, you know, a good 40 minutes away. And so only recently people have been able to have their own shops back because they were completely destroyed. And then, you know, we had the flooding last year, which really hit Umzinyathi, which is our neighboring township, very, very hard. I mean, for weeks we had the rescue teams coming to search for people, largely because, you know, houses are built really close together, not on strong foundations. And then this year we've even had a tornado. So it's been a really hard community.
When I hear you talking, I mean, if you want to understand the reality, I suppose, of living in South Africa, the majority of people that were living in South Africa, this is not a suburban kind of setting. Although this is an amazing educational place, it's at the heart of, and maybe it's difficult to say, but at the heart of the problems in our country, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's sitting right there, and the girls who are coming to the school, they're coming from that context. And so how did you end up, you've been here for 6 years. So I feel like I really connected with you. Maybe I want to say grade 9, but probably it was a little bit, and that's a long time ago. But and so look, that's part of our history together. But how did you kind of find yourself in chaplaincy? Obviously, you've understood a call or a vocation to ministry. I mean, it's one of the things I introduced this season with, about almost like this idea of a holy discontent, that there's stuff that we feel like there's something wrong. You know, we feel like we don't feel okay about this. And we think, Lord, should I be a part of doing something about you making this not right, but advancing your kingdoms in the area? So how did you end up, you know, as a minister in the congregational church, in youth ministry, and in a school?
you were really there for the start of it. But I think back, so I suppose kind of going into ministry would be before going into chaplaincy, that kind of call, because that's kind of led from one to the other.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have memories and journal entries as far back as 2004, where I spoke about my sense of call into ordained ministry specifically. Mm. And so I can say it with great confidence, at least grade 10, possibly even grade 9, which is almost 20 years, right? That's nearly 2024. And I'm still on that path. I've had a few detours, not kind of very notable. I wouldn't say any significant like turnings away and comings back, but just I suppose part of the discernment process was to make sure, like, is this, and so to test other routes and say for a year, actually just in my gap year, which you know much about, and my just like figuring out, is this call there? Because if you go into ministry, it's not a very broad spectrum, you know. Well, I mean, you can do a lot within ministry, but if you suddenly decide like actually it's not it, so I wanted to make sure. And so yeah, I kind of went at the end of that year and really felt that the call was still there, had discerned it with my church and with mentors. And so I started university at 18 doing my Bachelor of Theology. Knew I was really young, and so kind of meandered through studies and really enjoyed that, saw it as an opportunity to grow my experience, my knowledge. Got two master's degrees, and I ended up being ordained in 2018, so about 28. And you know, it's a real lesson for me. I often have to remind myself that you know, when I deal a lot with 15-year-olds now, and I can completely see why no one took me seriously. I have to remind myself that, you know, we cannot underestimate teenage faith, because you know, I know my story pretty well.
Yeah,
and yeah, and I'm very grateful that a lot of people didn't underestimate it. A lot of people were really kind of encouraging, and not just in a very practical ways, you know.
Yeah.
And so I got was on that journey for a long time, and I actually never considered the school as an option, even though I have quite a long history with it. My grandfather was very involved in the church. He was a lawyer, but very much within the UCCSA, which was a very justice-focused church, congregational church, and he. You know, they built schools and hospitals wherever the kind of missionaries were. That was part of their call, wasn't just to see the spiritual side of people made whole, but the whole person. And so my grandfather sat on the board at the school in the 80s.
Wow.
And and then I became really good friends with the American missionary who was chaplain here before me for 18 years. And she became a really good mentor and friend. And I did my grade 11 work experience under her as chaplain at an under seminary. But you know, even in that time, I never once considered it as a place I would end up. I always thought that maybe chaplaincy would be somewhere along the line, having kind of been a teenager with faith, would have some kind of resonance with being a chaplaincy. But I thought it would be when I was older. And to be honest, I thought it would be at my old school. And then when kind of conversation started and the timing seemed like it would be good, you know, for me to come to the school, and there was a conversation going. It was a real kind of test of the call when the week before I'd planned to kind of officially sign to say, you know, this is it, I'm coming. My old school, the four people reached out to me on the same morning saying, the chaplaincy's come, you know, become available. Would you consider it? We think you'd be great. And I was like, God, this is, you know, what I'd always imagined. Is this it?
Yeah.
And I remember kind of messaging a few people, and my uncle just wrote back and said, that's great, but where is the call? And I just knew it wasn't under. I knew that this was my season to be here for so many reasons, but just, you know, what resonated with me, what, the things that are important to me was here. And I'm very grateful.
And so, I mean, just to flesh that out a little bit, that's that sense of calling. I mean, I think that for yourself, you speak of there were some things that were dear to you. I mean, there's a difference between opportunity, right? Because there's lots of opportunities. And there's that sense of like, okay, but I know God really wants me here. Now, I don't know, can you, because often that's quite a mysterious place for people, right? And often I know we don't always find words, but like, are you able to articulate that a little bit? You know, in some way, just that idea of, I know, because calling is, sometimes it can be super practical, right?
Yeah.
And other times it's just like, you know, like, you know, like, you know,
I think the one thing though that I've learned is that calling doesn't always mean
It doesn't always mean comfortable or fun. You know, a call is something you can't avoid. When I was going into ministry, one of my mentors said to me, stay out of ministry until you can stay out no more. And that was really helpful because I'd I'd really enjoyed ministry in high school. I'd had some really, really good exposure to really healthy spaces. And then there were a number of years within studying at university, studying abroad, even part of my internship, which were incredibly difficult. And even in those spaces, it was a sense of, you know, I don't want to be here. I don't always want to be serving in this way, but there's something that's bigger than me that's keeping me here, you know? And I mean, that sounds quite airy-fairy, but it's not just one stream that you're hearing that from. It's not just like your own internal thing. It's other people seeing it. It's scripture speaking to you. It's, you know, in your quiet time, it's more than one facet that kind of speaks into that. And I often refer back to a quote by Thomas Cranmer, which I think it's by him. It's the only reference. I heard someone say it in Googling. It's the only kind of reference where I can see it's ascribed to someone. But I think it really captures so much of what I've been through. And it says, God's love takes us on journeys we do not wish to travel, along roads we do not wish to use, to take us to places that we never wish to leave. But I don't think it's unique to me. I think that we all have it, you know? And I don't think God necessarily says, you know, you have to go here or there. For some of us, he does. And for some seasons of our life, he might say it's here. But we can all exercise our ministry wherever we're at. And we can all kind of figure out that sense of purpose and of being part of a better picture wherever we are. And so, yeah, I know that mine is quite specific. And there will be other people who kind of more in corporate, who might have for a time a very specific call, you know, by God to be CEO of this company, but to treat people in this way, which is maybe better or a better witness, you know, that kind of thing. And so I suppose I always hope that people who kind of hear that don't, you know, my story, never, they'd rather get excited and say, like, actually, I can have that sense of call too. It's not just for me. I know that. I think I'm quite lucky having had it in before I had to make decisions in matric, because it was, you know, quite difficult. I see a lot of people, you know, wanting to desperately be within God's will, but what am I going to do for matric? Well, actually, I think sometimes a calling is not necessarily a job description, but who we are within whatever job description we're doing. And so it's, I suppose that's part of my journey, and maybe it'll be the same for me, you know, where's next kind of might be God saying, well, I want you to do this kind of thing, but what spaces do you want to do it? Because we partner with God so much in our calling. You know, Inanda was for me quite a specific call, but I don't imagine that every call will be, I know it's here. It might be, I know it's this purpose or this way, but God kind of gives us freedom often to say, well, where do you want to exercise that? What creative ways are you being drawn to that might be a way to live it out in your own life? And so, yeah, I think that's kind of how I've understood calling, because it's very easy to limit it to kind of me, who's maybe too textbooked at times when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I know that God is bigger than that. He's more exciting than that. He's more adventurous than that. I mean, maybe I'm just so used to my own life. People might look at me and say, oh, you're living in a township, you know, that's not textbook, but yeah, maybe within ministry it might be kind of what's expected. So
I mean, I love that picture of, you know, when you use words like God is more adventurous than we think, right? And I love that idea of that picture of like partnering with God, being co-creators, you know, that there's as much as at times, like you say, God can be so intentional and so specific with something, at other times he invites us into the freedom of his will. And I love what you said earlier about that sometimes it's not always about placing people, but who we will be in that, you know, and sometimes we can always define calling as like a particular task or thing and not about character and, you know, Christ-like character. So I love that. And so, look, we could talk a lot more about calling. That's probably for another podcast series, right, around vocation and things. But so here you are at Inanda. Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges. I mean, we touched on that a little bit earlier as we started to speak about the context of the township itself. Maybe share a couple of stories with us around some of your encounters with some of the girls, and kind of what's maybe unfolded a little bit there. I suppose some of the realities of the everydayness of being in your setting.
I mean, so COVID kind of feels long gone, but I think we're starting to see different effects of it, which maybe I don't know, but I'm not sure, or maybe as felt within some of the private sector kind of education places. So we as a school lost 100 girls. We're a school of 430, we're about 330. We're a private school, kind of fee dependent school. And that obviously was quite an unexpected drop and shift. And so we are rebuilding, and there is hope. It doesn't feel completely, but it's going to be another, you know, hard few years because we didn't have a lot of fat anyway. And so now we're trying to juggle, you know, still being affordable, but there's skyrocketing food prices. We're a boarding school, you know, all that kind of thing. And sometimes it can feel overwhelming, but I've been really impressed by some of my colleagues who've just seen it as a way to get creative, you know, how can we do excellence with less? And, you know, how do we prioritize what's really important? You know, we've got Chromebooks for pretty much all the girls, Wi-Fi across the campus, you know, but it's, you know, the other things that we don't have, and we've decided aren't going to be what we have because we'd rather prioritize those kinds of things. So that's one reality. Also, the girls coming into the system. So we are seeing maybe more than in COVID years. When COVID happened, a lot of the kind of private schools where everyone has data and devices kind of had the seamless switch to online. We tried it. It didn't work because not everyone has data. Where people live don't always have coverage. Not everyone has devices. Smartphones are not a given. So we actually brought the girls back really quickly. Our members arrived kind of June, July, somewhere, as soon as they were allowed to. Because we were a boarding school, a lot of our staff live on campus. We just became a closed system. And girls weren't allowed home. It was tough, but we did it. And so we had school, kind of life carried on. But now we're finding girls coming into high school who were at schools who didn't happen for 2 years. And so there's huge gaps in foundational knowledge. And so coming in and saying, cool, we've got 5 years, you've got to do 8 years of teaching or 7 years of teaching. You know, how are we going to do this? Are we up for the challenge? Using reflective maths to try and pick up where the girls are, the gaps are for the individuals, you know, using technology in that way. And so, you know, that's going to be a long time until the COVID years are out of the system, you know, a good 12 years at least, until those gaps are kind of filled. But also kind of more, you know, you can't lead where you haven't been, and the world is changing at this crazy fast pace. You know, I remember 5 years after school, I was just thinking, sure, the girls at school, Facebook kind of arrived in 2007, I'd already finished school. So just remember thinking about 5 years after school, like these girls are having, I was involved in other schools around the area I was studying, thinking like these girls are having experience. I didn't, because I didn't grow up in social media. I'm only 5 years older than them. I'm like just not a teenager, and yet I can't relate. And now we're finding it again, you know, ChatGPT is like revolutionized teaching. And it's, I teach, you know, I do work experience with my grade 11s in life orientation, and suddenly like the world of work in 10 years time, like, I don't know what's going to happen. Like how, and so we're having to shift that completely as well. You know, what jobs are we preparing people for? Well, we don't know. And so we're having to see a real shift in terms of, you know, well, we have to teach the girls to be resilient, to be able to, you know, have ingenuity and stuff like that rather than a skill, because cool, we can teach you how many legs a millipede has, but you can Google that in a second, you know, that kind of knowledge we knew was on its way out and suddenly it's gone, you know. And sure. I mean, yesterday someone said to me, I'm quite big on referencing. I spent a lot of time at university. I really drill it into the girls. They said, how do you reference ChatGPT? And I was like, I have no idea. You know, you write down the question you wrote to it, or I don't know, you know, I have to find out. And that's, you know, those kind of things. It's like happening faster than, I mean, maybe I should know how you reference ChatGPT, but it's just not something I've ever thought about, you know?
And I think so everyone's still trying to work that out.
But I mean, even for me, you can get ChatGPT to write sermons, you know? Yeah. Just put in what approach you want, and you're suddenly like, oh gosh, maybe that's, I mean, and so part of that is saying, Well, actually, the reality is that we're going to have to teach people the human elements, because you see grade eights kind of talking to ChatGPT as if it's a friend. You know, I'm feeling really sad today. And ChatGPT says, here's some things to cheer you up. And so how do we teach that human element? How do we or retain that human element when it's so tempting to turn to something which, in as far as we know, doesn't break your trust the same way a friend can? You know, I don't know. And so it's quite difficult. And I know that we're not, Inanda's not unique in this. You see, you know, top universities having these questions and ChatGPT is passing their board exams at the highest level, you know. It's like, we're all having to ask this question, like, sure, what's happening? But, you know, you've got teenagers looking to you in this chaotic world and you're like, oh, I'm feeling the chaos too, you know. But like, exactly. How do we, like, stay ahead of the curve? How do we expose ourselves to those, you know, thought leaders and stuff like that, to be able to like bring us back to say, cool, we don't have answers, but we can show you which kind of direction to start heading in and hope that that's, you know, a good one.
Just, I suppose, kind of in closing, tell us a little bit about for you, I suppose, the power. I mean, we've listened a little bit to it anyhow. Just think back to some of the things you've said already, but the power of the church being involved in education or in a school and the value of that.
So, I mean, as a school, we're quite unashamedly a Christian school. We have chapel in the mornings, we have chapel on Sundays. I would say that we're not an imposing, I don't know, you know, people are not forced to sing worship songs. You are not, you have to be in chapel, but there's no kind of expectation for you to pray or that kind of thing. And in fact, I think as a school, we're quite open to girls having a mature faith. So we're not afraid of questions. In fact, I think we probably encourage questions of faith, because that's how you get a mature faith. And that's not just me. That's the culture I came into. That's the other staff members who might preach or have conversations about faith in, you know, classrooms and stuff like that. But I think that there is value in it, because, you know, kind of what I mentioned before, you know, the world kind of feels a chaotic place. KZN, especially in the last few years, has felt a very chaotic place. And so looking at things like values, which I don't think cause faith, but often faith can instill values. We have a lot of focus on our core values, because when the world feels like it's rocking and you're trying to find your space in it, you need things that root you. And so Christ for many, or the church for many, is a space of rootedness. And so even if individuals don't necessarily subscribe to that, there is a sense of being rooted that the school has, you know, rooted in the fact that God has been faithful for the last 150 years. We often rely on that grace, you know, and there's a sense of being rooted that, whether people kind of acknowledge or not, or realize, that comes from that space. And so being a church school, we also, you know, issues of justice are really important to us because of faith, looking around us and saying, cool, in fact, in Inanda, we're the fattened calf. We have a lot. And so it's been amazing to see our previous principal, who's still kind of affiliated heavily with the school, start an organization that is saying, cool, we can educate 300-400 girls here and change, you know, hope that they're going to be like the alumni who have done incredible things, but actually the problem is bigger than that. And so starting to go within to the schools, many of which started as the Sunday schools that the members went out to 100, you know, whatever years ago, those Sunday schools became schools and now they're primary schools and they're official, you know. But we now have a teachers intern program that has 180 teacher interns. They get 3 days in service training where they have supervision, you know, every 1 or 2 weeks by a really experienced teacher, who then does input. They have 1 day of academic training where they come here to the school's campus and learn things like Google Classroom and stuff, which for many, you know, might just say, well, we know about that. But for most of our country, that's a whole new world, right? To have online teaching, you know, where all my girls submit all their assignments online. And that's just kind of expected. And to teach that to our future teachers. And then they have 1 day of academic support. You know, there's no point in training them if they're not going to pass the exams or don't have access to devices to do their assignments, to have people to ask, you know. So the school's kind of seeing this space, and that's all driven by faith. You know, those are all people. When I look at the individuals who kind of have driven that, it's because, you know, they don't just pray, thy kingdom come,
on earth as it is in heaven as a like nice future thing. It's all saying on earth right now as it is in heaven, how do I bring justice and love and that here and seeing people kind of translating that into action. So, you know, you could kind of say, well, church has to be really careful, the school and churches have to be really careful about what they say or what they do. But if your overarching kind of drive is love, it just means you have a deeper well to draw from. And we've needed to draw from it in times that's tough. And, you know, do you have more capacity for children who are coming from problem homes because they're disruptive? And instead of doing, you know, discipline that's kind of punitive, you say, well, how do we restore? How do we take this child, understand their context, understand why they're behaving in the way that they are, and loving them in a way that shows Christ? I mean, you never actually have to say Jesus' name, you know, to be able to do that. And then people ask questions. People say, but you're different. And so, yeah, well, we're not necessarily, we are definitely a church school. I mean, the church, the UCCSA owns the school. It's like very much a part of its history and that kind of stuff. I think those who serve within the school see Christ's call as very practical, as like, you know, intangible ways. How can we love these girls well? The love that I've received from God, the comfort, you know, from the God of comfort that I've received. How do we pass that on in a really hurting world? And I, you know, I've seen it within my own life. When I came into the school, it was a place of nurturing and healing for me, which has enabled me to be able to give others the opportunity for healing and nurturing. And that's just because of its kind of ethos. And I don't necessarily think that schools that don't choose, you know, to be Christian are not capable of loving or, you know, that kind of thing. We all reflect God, even if we're all made in the image of God, you know, whether we acknowledge it or realize it or whatever you want to say. I mean, people really can and do amazing stuff. But there's a real beauty that I've loved in just being in a place where, you know, where that kind of service is invited, where a sense of call, you know, our principal really is called for such a time as this. It's not, and that carries you. That carries you, you know, a lot further than maybe sometimes you think you can go. Yeah, so I think that's the offering, is that this place, and I'm sure other church schools, other schools which are grounded in faith, you may have to be careful about what you say, but how you live that out can still be very obvious, can still be a real gift to whichever students are walking your hallways or your pathways. And yeah, I suppose that's the hope, is that I often think there's a verse that I've had on my wall, often in my kitchen, you know, at times. I don't have a lot of verses or crosses. That's not kind of really who I am, but there's one that's kind of maintained, and it's from 1 Thessalonians. And it says, because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well.
What a powerful scripture to end our time together. If you'd like to find out more about Enunda Seminary, you can find them at enunda.org. Thank you again to Ethan for the music. If you're into liking, sharing, and subscribing, please do that for the podcast. You've been listening to Remember the Way with me, Xavier. May the peace of the Lord be with you and your loved ones.